This podcast is sponsored by Monarch Money. Are you saving to reach your financial goals? Reaching those goals isn't just about getting more money, but by managing what you have. And the best way to manage your money? Monarch Money. Monarch Money is a new kind of finance app that's intuitive, powerful, ad-free, and takes the headaches out of budgeting. Try it free when you go to monarchmoney.com/podcast. Monarch puts all your accounts, investments, transactions, and finances at your fingertips. With a complete view of your finances, you'll gain insights on your spending and find new ways to save. Plus, Monarch lets you customize your dashboard, collaborate with your partner, set custom budgets and goals, and track your progress toward them. See why Mint users are turning to Monarch Money and loving it, and why the Wall Street Journal named Monarch Money the best budgeting app overall. Get a 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/podcast. That's monarchmoney.com/podcast for your free trial. monarchmoney.com/podcast.
MSW Media.
They might be giants have been on the road for too long.
Too long.
And they might be giants aren't even sorry.
Not even sorry.
And audiences like the shows too much.
Too much.
And now they might be giants are playing their breakthrough album, Flood.
All of it.
And they still have time for other songs.
They're fooling around.
Who can stop They Might Be Giants and their liberal rock agenda?
Who?
No one.
This ad was paid for with somebody else's money.
The rule of law is not just some lawyer's turn of phrase. It is the very foundation of our democracy. The essence of the rule of law is that like cases are treated. That there not be one rule for Democrats and another for Republicans, one rule for the powerful, another for the powerless, one rule for the rich, and another for the poor, or different rules depending upon one's race or ethnicity. To serve as Attorney General at this critical time is a calling I am honored and eager to answer.
So yeah, now it's clean up on aisle 45 time. And for a long while yet, it is going to be clean up on aisle 45.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 35 of Clean Up on Aisle 45. It's Wednesday, September 15th. We're going to have to do something for special for episode 45 of Clean Up.
Absolutely.
Or maybe we just skip 45 and go right to episode 46, like how there's no 13th floor.
Yeah, we'll do a 44A and B episode and then a 46. Yeah,
I like it. I'm your co-host, Allison Gill. With me, as always, is Andrew Torres.
Oh, Allison, thank you so much. Can't wait to get into the show. Our main story is the DOJ fighting back against SB8 in Texas. And we have additional updates from the DOJ. Plus, of course, comings and goings, including a story about a certain serial Hatch Act violator that I know you're going to want to weigh in on. But first, as always, we have to thank our new patrons who have supported us over at patreon.com/aisle45pod for as little as $1 an episode.
Yes, that is right. So a very sincere thank you to Far Harder, McF, which could be MCF or short for McFuck. I'm not sure.
MCF. I like to think MCF, dropping the sick beats, right?
That's... Okay. All right. Now, and then we have Alice Lutris. We have person number 42. Excellent. Answer to life, the universe, and everything that person has. Oh, I like this. We have one called Briar Should Retire, and then Keith Phillips, and then the Calvin and Hobbes Cast Podcast.
Those sound great. Thank you all so much for supporting the show. That's over at patreon.com/aisle45pod. And now on to the A block.
So we begin with where we left off last week, Texas SB8, and what we're going to do about it. We both told you that if Merrick Garland didn't do more than just condemn it, he wasn't trying hard enough. And sure enough, the day after our episode dropped, Garland had a major press conference and announced that the Department of Justice would be suing Texas in federal court regarding the constitutionality of SB8. Now, I'm not saying it was us. Might have had more to do with the House Judiciary letter and perhaps Lawrence Tribe, or maybe he started writing this the minute that SB8 dropped out of the gate. But either way, it happened. So let's break it down.
Yeah, I mean, still most likely us, but we begin as always, by reading the complaint backwards. And even here, we're going to start with the signature block because this is a first for me. There are 13 different DOJ lawyers listed on this complaint. That may be a record. I certainly cannot recall ever having seen that much public brain power assigned to a single lawsuit before. So, you know, that is big firm levels of staffing. It says that the DOJ has made this a real priority.
Yeah, I've never seen like more than four, I think. Yep. Maybe five back in the old Flintstone times. But the complaint seeks a declaratory judgment. That is, that SB8, they want the court to declare it unconstitutional and therefore null and void because it is, and injunctive relief, a preliminary and permanent injunction against the state of Texas, including not only the state actors, but all private parties who would bring suit under the law, thus prohibiting any enforcement of SB8. The three grounds set forth in this complaint, this is truly so well put together. Number one is the Supremacy Clause of the 14th Amendment, right? Which makes sense. I thought of that one. Two, preemption. I thought of that one. But then three, something called intergovernmental immunity, which, whoa, cool. I mean, they weren't kidding when they said, we're going to look into every single legal avenue that we can.
Yeah, and I want to say at the outset, you are right to pause over intergovernmental immunity, right? It is not a very common doctrine. All three of these causes of action are rooted in the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution. Okay. And just to break that down, that's Article 6, Clause 2, which says that the Constitution and any federal laws, quote, shall be the supreme law of the land, anything in a state constitution or the laws of any state notwithstanding, right? So the question is, how does SB8 violate the Constitution and or federal law?
Right. And this seems super easy for count one, then.
Yeah.
Right. Texas SB8 violates the Constitution, as we understand it, from Planned Parenthood v. Casey and Roe v. Wade, because it deprives a pregnant person of their constitutional right to obtain a pre-viability abortion. And that applies to the states through the incorporation doctrine under the 14th Amendment. Do I have that?
Exactly right. So that's count one. Count two is about preemption. And here's what that means, right? Congress has the exclusive authority to do certain things, the most well-known of which is to regulate interstate commerce, right? But that doesn't mean that states are de facto prohibited from doing anything that can affect interstate commerce. So let me give you a really easy example, right? Maryland has a state sales tax of 6%. Maryland borders Delaware. Delaware has zero sales tax, so the state of Delaware is free to buy billboards along I-95 that say, come to Delaware, home of tax-free shopping, right? And induce Marylanders to cross the border and buy stuff in Delaware, right? That's interstate commerce, but they're still free to do it.
And you're saying the federal government could step in and stop that if they wanted to, but they don't have to?
Yeah, that's right. So there are a long line of cases we don't need to get into in the weeds, right, where the federal government has prevented states from imposing certain kinds of taxes within their state because the effects that would have on interstate commerce. The important thing is it's the federal government's choice, right? So when Congress passes a federal law, it can specify that law does one of three things. Number one, it could do nothing, right? Like it can work in concert with state laws. You just have both laws at the same time with zero restraint on the state's power. Number two, it can preempt any conflicting state law. And that's sort of the important one here. And preemption is implied whenever a federal law would say, you shall do X, and a state law would say, you cannot do X, right? Mm. If they're in conflict, the Supremacy Clause says the federal law takes priority, right? And then third, it can occupy the field, actually, right? You can say, there will be no state laws that even touch on that same area, even if they're not precisely the same, even if they don't inherently conflict. Because again, supremacy, federal government gets control over interstate commerce, right? So, and then on the flip side, when we're not talking about laws, when we're talking about constitutional liberties, right? When a state passes a law that conflicts with those constitutional rights, you can go to a court and argue that state law is preempted.
Okay. Yeah, this sort of makes sense to me, and you know, with insofar as my government position, and that, you know, in California, if you want to be a nurse, it's by law you have to be licensed to be a nurse. But if you work at the VA, you can move from state to state, and you don't have to be licensed in all those states. And that policy, I guess, would sort of preempt what any state would require.
Yeah, that makes total sense. Yes.
All right, cool. I got it. And I'm also thinking of like, you know, cannabis consumption, stuff like that. But that's all weird, but same. And that's exactly what we have here, right? This is section 3 of the complaint. It notes the way SB 8 affects interstate commerce. This begins at paragraph 36, which notes that SB 8 forces pregnant people who wish to obtain constitutionally protected abortions and related services to travel out of Texas to other states in order to exercise their constitutional rights, and it hinders businesses and nonprofits engaged in this commercial activity. And then paragraph 37 notes that clinics in Oklahoma, Louisiana, New Mexico, Colorado, and Kansas are being inundated with a surge of pregnant people. And you and I both reported on that and those stories in our respective other shows.
Yeah, yeah, we did. And then, so that's preemption, right? The idea is...
Here comes my favorite part, though.
Yeah. This is the most clever part of the argument, count 3, the intergovernmental immunity point, right? And that argument is that SB 8 impermissibly burdens federal government obligations, right? It is a state purporting to tell the federal government what it can and can't do, which directly contradicts the Supremacy Clause. And these arguments are, they're very technical, but they're really good, right? This begins on page 16, if you're following along. There are at least 6 different federal government programs that SB 8 would prevent from doing what they've promised to do, right? So let's start off with the first example in the complaint, the Job Corps, right? That applies to people ages 16 to 24. There are 4 federal Job Corps centers in Texas. It's a public-private partnership, so they're privately administrated. If you signed up for the federal Jobs Corps program, let's say in 2020, right? And that program is a federal program. It is funded by Congress. It is administered by the Federal Department of Labor, an executive branch, right? You get, when you sign up, a policy and requirements handbook, right? That's just like any employee manual. It tells you the terms of the job, and the case law is super duper clear. That's a binding contract, right? That's what your employer says. These are your responsibilities. Here are your rights. And that handbook says enrollees in the program have the right to have access to pregnancy related services, including information and services related to abortion. And it also says that those Job Corps centers must identify, quote, available community health and social resources and services, and make arrangements for transportation so that if you're enrolled in the program, you can access those resources and obtain those services, which include an abortion.
Yeah, and I never even thought of this, right? I was thinking, Andrew, from a military standpoint, being like, hey, if you're in the military, 30,000 women, I don't know how many people who are able to get pregnant, but 30,000 women stationed in Texas, active duty service in the military. The federal government owns and controls their bodies. And I thought that there might be some sort of a supremacy problem, a supremacy clause problem with the state telling the federal government what these women cannot do with their bodies. But they left that completely out of here. But this is along the lines.
With an asterisk, let's get to that. Yeah.
Right. Because it is kind of brought up. So, I mean, but if we think about it, it means that if you signed up for the Job Corps in 2020, like you said, the federal government promised that if you got pregnant, it would make arrangements for you, not just allow you to, but it would have to help make arrangements for you. This is a contract to have access to your constitutional right to an abortion. But SB 8 imposes civil liability, $10,000 plus, to anyone who facilitates or pays for an abortion or aids and abets an abortion. Yep. So the state law would supersede the federal obligation. And that makes no sense if the Constitution is the supreme law of the land. It goes directly violates the Supremacy Clause.
Yep, that is exactly right. And your point on the military, here's how that was translated into the lawsuit, right? Any DOD employee, right, is covered by TRICARE for their medical care, right? And just as in the Job Corps, we were clear to say, because you can't pass any federal program where it will pay for a voluntary abortion because our country is irredeemably screwed, right?
I see, yeah, because this gets around the whole Hyde Amendment thing.
Yeah.
Because of what TRICARE covers.
Right. And go ahead. I mean, You were subject to TRICARE. Yes.
Yes, and it does cover abortion services that are the result of rape or incest. So that is, seems to me like one fatal flaw. I mean, one of a million fatal flaws of this law by leaving out the rape and incest part. They could have circumvented this very particular thing, probably not anything else. But you know what I'm, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and there are multiple federal obligations, right, to pay for, to federally fund abortions that are the result of rape or incest, right? And think about what that means, right? That is such an overwhelming supermajority of this country believes that you should have access, regardless of your financial level, to an abortion in the event of rape or incest, that that made it into the law where virtually everything else did not. So SB 8, no exception. Under the same pays for provision, SB 8 would allow vigilantes to sue TRICARE every time they reimburse an abortion for rape or incest, right? And that kind of nonsense, right, where a state could allow you to effectively tax a federal institution has been prohibited for two centuries since McCulloch versus Maryland, right? Way back when Maryland tried to tax the Second Federal Bank of the United States in 1819. States cannot impair federal obligations.
Yeah, and so the same thing is true for other federal government employees, right? It's mm-hmm. also true for prison inmates. Bureau of Prisons yeah. bears the cost if a person is raped in prison and then has to have an abortion. BOP also permits inmates to elect to have an abortion, and both of those obligations are in danger thanks to SB 8. So, okay, this seems like a very good legal argument to me, but I do have a quick question for you, Andrew.
Mm-hmm.
Could the decision here be to carve out these exceptions and for the Supreme Court to say, you big stupid dummies, you didn't think about Job Corps, you didn't think about the federal government's obligations, we're carving those out, this just applies to everybody else. I mean, is that a plausible scenario?
That's an excellent question, and the analysis that any court is going to do that. It's sometimes called blue penciling when you rescue a contract, right? Where you just sort of sever out the terms of the contract that are unconstitutional. And that can happen with laws as well. The question becomes, and this was raised in the various Obamacare cases, right? How intrinsically linked are the provisions you're looking to sever from what you're looking to do? And again, here, I feel like this is part of the well-researched aspect of this lawsuit, is to show how intrinsic the notion of abortion being tied to this made-up fetal heartbeat thing. You could not just excise certain provisions of SB 8. You would have to actively rewrite the law. You'd have to put in a specific provision for rape and incest, and that would be contrary to what the state legislature said. Right? Mm. That it strikes me as highly unlikely that a court is going to go to that end. They're going to say, look, like, that this is what the legislature passed, and if you want to carve out the unconstitutional stuff, you're going to have to carve out the heart of the law. Because remember, in addition, you have the aiding and abetting, facilitating clauses, and all of those government obligations require these various government agencies or officials, federal officials, to make information available, to arrange for transportation, and because of how broad SB 8 is written, they're all potentially legally liable to vigilantes in Texas under SB 8. So it's well done. So that's not a thing that I'm worried about.
Yeah, and I love the jurisdictional or standing argument. You mm-hmm. tell me which one it is that says, hey, just because these are private citizens that are enforcing this law, that doesn't mean it's separate from the state. You can't divorce that from the state. You're officially or essentially deputizing these vigilantes, making them an arm of the state, which gives us standing to bring all of this in the first place, right?
Yeah, and I like, look, that is an incredibly thorny area, right? This is section 2 beginning on page 9. The way I like that this lawsuit is written is that it kind of proceeds backwards. starts, right? It begins with the idea that, of course, the United States can stop a law that imposes state obligations on a federal, a government agency. Like, there must be the power to do that. So therefore, however you reach that, you cannot
figure it out. It's the contrary result.
Yeah.
It's like when I get my bill from the restaurant and it's like $46.18 and I put 60 and then the word math in the tip line.
Right. Yeah.
That's what I immediately thought of.
And the section goes out of its way to document that all of the private enforcement was carefully crafted as a pretext in order to prevent judicial review of this statute and to say, Court, you know, you should look at this and to be incredibly skeptical. And I love that because, you know, as we have both been doing from day one, getting the message out to the public that, you know, that the fundamental threshold question of, is this a fair thing to do? Is this a reasonable thing to do? Right. Is always on the table, no matter how complicated the law sounds. So.
Yeah. Well, I think that this is, I think they have a good chance. But the question here is, I mean, you know, with my concern with the military women in Texas is because currently, without the passage of the Military Justice Act, women who are in the military or people who can get pregnant in the military don't have a safe place to report their rapes. There is no rape and incest objection. So I'm thinking, can we please, if we have the votes, pass this? So, you know, when Abbott gets up and says, oh, we're just going to get rid of all the rapists. We could have done this the whole time, but we're just deciding to now. I'm like, well, could you at least give women in the military or people who can get pregnant in the military a safe place to report where they have a chance of getting their rapist prosecuted and brought to justice? And, you know, I was upset because they took it out of the Senate, threw it into the NDAA. It's going to take a year to go into effect. My concern is the impact now on people who can get pregnant in Texas right now. So how long is this going to take? I mean,
yeah,
especially with the courts backed up. I mean, this is what, Fifth Circuit?
Yes, it will be. This was brought in the U.S. District Court in Texas. Will go up to the Fifth Circuit. You are right to be concerned because the answer is not immediately, and I'm not sure how long ultimately it will take for the Western District of Texas to issue a permanent injunction in this case. I believe that they will. I mean, the law is just crystal clear. But, you know, I thought the Supreme Court would enforce the law, too. So,
yeah, but you know, why not ask for an emergency stay? They seem to be handing them out like fucking gumballs.
Yeah, well, so as you point out, this does not include an emergency request for a TRO or a stay. I think that is done strategically because you would derail that argument with the question of whether that is res judicata from the Supreme Court's denial of the Fifth Circuit's refusal to enter an injunction.
Basically, they could shadow docket your ass again.
Yeah. And I think the idea is to get the time running on this right away. So this does not include an emergency request. It does not include a motion to expedite, right? So at minimum, state of Texas gets a month to answer or move to dismiss, right? They're probably going to move to dismiss. That's probably going to be a few months of briefing. I think given the way that this is articulated, that we're likely to see an early summary judgment motion because there aren't, like, most of these are not questions of fact. They are questions of law, right? But I mean, you are right.
They're not arguing like, what is a fetus? When is the heartbeat? What is this?
No.
This is like, I'm the federal government and you're fucking my shit up and you can't do that because you're a state. Peace out.
Yep. That's right. And they can attach affidavits to a summary judgment motion to that effect the state of Texas will not be able to dispute, you know, that it impermissibly burdens federal government employees. They can say, oh, we don't intend to enforce it in that way. But that's not a great legal argument. Yeah, your snorting is appropriate there. Right. So
these aren't going to be like Corona affidavits. I mean, these are going to.
No. they're going to do their best. But you are correct. this is what we meant when we spent most of the episode last week explaining how drastic the Supreme Court's actions were. This law, SB 8, is in effect now. It is forcing pregnant people. It is forcing women. It is forcing people across the border, right, of Texas into neighboring states. It is driving clinics out of business. And every day the law is in effect, pregnant people are being denied their basic constitutional rights. And they shouldn't be. We should be a country of laws. And on this issue, we're not because of zealots on the Supreme Court.
God, what a dark time, but what a brilliant lawsuit brought by the Department of Justice. Mm-hmm. I have to say, there are things like some in certain points I was like, yeah, this and yeah, that. But there are some things I just never even pondered that they threw in there. And not just because they're doing a Sidney Powell and just throwing the kitchen sink at you. It's because these are extremely excruciating, well thought out legal arguments that all apply and all have meaning and merit. And I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens here. But I'm glad we got to break this down because I feel like even though there are, like you said, pregnant people in Texas right now being denied their constitutional right, I think it's important to cover how thorough and succinct that this particular lawsuit was and is. And I can't see it losing, honestly.
Neither can I. And that terrifies me to say. I will just say,
we still have another hearing on the Mississippi case coming up, which they could they could gut Roe in a whole different and new way.
That has been briefed and will likely be calendared for oral argument in November, which means we're looking at April to May for the opinion on that. April to May of 2022.
Unless it's super bad and Justice Roberts tries to delay it, then we might not see it till June. We'll see what happens. But
we will see.
I don't want to laugh about it because what I'm fully honestly terrified for is decision.
We know what's coming in that decision that's been telegraphed.
And we should prep for that.
What you can ask for. Yeah. What you can ask for, right, is for the Democratic administration and a Democratic-run Department of Justice to do everything in its power to fight SB 8, and this meets that criteria. If you're asking why can't they just fiat the state of Texas out of existence, you can't do magic, right? What we're asking for is, do the people we put in power do everything in their power to stand up for individual rights here, and in my view, this qualifies, and it signals a real commitment.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
And I implore the Department of Justice and in this administration to start tabletop exercises about potential outcomes about the Mississippi case, and to start thinking about it now. Now, because we can't keep delaying this stuff. All right. We will be right back. We have some other things that the Department of Justice has done in the last week that we need to talk about, but we have to take a quick break. Stay with us. Hey, everybody. It's AG for Cleanup on Aisle 45. Every year, U.S. businesses waste over $400 billion. That's $400 billion because bad writing. It causes confusion, misses the mark, takes too long to get to the point. On the flip side, better writing also helps businesses win and impress customers, enhances brand perception, improves internal communication, and strengthens relationships with critical partners. Better, faster writing means better business, which is why your team needs WordTune for Teams. Going way beyond simple spelling and grammar correction, WordTune is the only AI-powered writing tool that not only understands meaning, but intent, and offers writing suggestions that help anyone achieve clear and compelling writing. It's the ultimate writing tool to elevate your entire team's writing instantly. I was wondering how a writing tool could possibly do this, so I gave it a try. WordTune is so helpful, I was amazed at its ability to understand what I was getting at. You simply highlight the copy you want to revise, and WordTune offers you a variety of alternative wordings, plus the ability to shorten or lengthen a sentence if you want, or you can even change its tone. WordTune improves performance on any project, everything from internal emails and press releases to sales outreach and customer service support, and so much more. You can use WordTune anywhere you're writing online, including Google Docs, Slack, Outlook Web, and WhatsApp, and more. You can try WordTune for free at wordtune.com/cleanup. And if you're looking to elevate your entire team's writing, you can get a discount for the team today at wordtune.com/cleanup. WordTune improves writing efficiency up to 4 times, and better, faster writing means better business. So start writing with WordTune at wordtune.com/cleanup. All right, everybody, welcome back. In addition to the Department of Justice lawsuit against Texas over SB8, which I am in love with, we have a few more stories from Maine Justice. The first comes from the Columbus Dispatch, and they report that the Justice Department has agreed to review Columbus, Ohio, and their Division of Police's pattern and policies, particularly pertaining to racial bias.
Yeah, that is right. Mayor of Columbus and City Attorney Zach Klein requested this review of the police division back in April.
But this is sort of different, right, Andrew, from the other patterns and practice investigations we've seen from the Department of Justice. They're already conducting in cities like Minneapolis and Louisville. This is different from that.
Yeah, yeah. So Klein said it would be different because the DOJ has agreed to look into Columbus as part of the larger community-oriented policing services, the COPS office, right? And it does not involve any litigation, right? Usually when the DOJ proactively steps in and issues a consent decree, it's because there's been a lawsuit that's been filed, right? And we know how those lawsuits get filed as part of the process. In this case, we're not waiting for a horrible case of police brutality against an African-American person. It's a preemptive move by Columbus to gain expertise from across the country on best practices. And you have to commend the entire process.
Yeah. And I don't think I haven't seen this kind of voluntary review in other cities, or at least not that I'm aware of, at least. Please, if you know of one, let us know. Write in, send it in. But Police Chief Elaine Bryant said the Department of Justice will be working on reviews of several areas she has identified as potential focus opportunities. Those include reviewing policies, officer training, technology, and an early warning system to try and identify officers who may be in need of services prior to a critical incident taking place. I assume, Andrew, that this request was in the form of a letter.
Yeah, that's right. So the letter said the city had made significant progress in recent years in police reform, but that they have met, quote, fierce opposition from leadership within the Columbus Police Division.
Oh, OK. So this is what makes it different. It appears that the mayor and the city attorney have been trying to implement some changes, but they aren't having the easiest time garnering cooperation from the cops. So they're inviting the Department of Justice to, I guess, you know, take a peek under the hood.
Yeah, that's right. And look, this is the kind of thing you have to do in a state like Ohio, where you have a Republican governor and slightly Republican legislature, right? Like in Maryland, for example, we just enacted police reform in 2020. And one of the most crucial aspects of that omnibus package, we covered this on OA, was taking institutional police officers not entirely out of the process, but bringing, I guess it's more accurate to say, bringing the community into that process, right? So prior to the Maryland reforms, we had police brutality complaints were handled by the police department.
Right.
And oftentimes it was the officer's superior, you know, who was being charged, who would be sitting there, adjudicating these claims. And what Maryland did was went to a 3-person panel where one person is a representative of the community, one person is an existing or retired judge, and then one person is a representative from the police department. Right. So So you're not disaggregating, the blue from the, but you are saying maybe we need some kind of outside checks and balances. So that's the kind of thing you can do legislatively. But if you don't have access to the legislature, this is incredibly clever. So the mayor, the city attorney, are not the only ones getting involved in this, right? Community members, including the newly formed Columbus Police Accountability Project, CPAP, also asked for the DOJ to conduct a review of the Columbus Police and attorney Sean Walton, one of the CPAP founders who has represented family members of people killed by police, said in a statement that the current planned involvement of the DOJ in Columbus is not enough. Presumably good starting point. And the police union right now has said that they are happy to cooperate. We'll see how long that lasts.
Yeah, I kept scrolling down in the article looking for the response from the head of the police union, the brotherhood, whatever, benevolent brotherhood of sweet, nice people or whatever the fuck they call themselves. And apparently they're like, hey, yeah, bring it on. So, I mean, I guess that would be sort of a, like, you've enlifted, bro, kind of a statement. So I'm kind of not surprised, because if they, you know, obviously if they were like, do you leave us alone? We're the cops. Then they would probably get a lot of backlash. So I think they're in the bring it on phase. Although, I'm not sure how long that would last. And I'm also wondering, Andrew, if any other departments in the country are going to make similar requests to the DOJ. This is, like I said, this is the first I've heard of the DOJ being asked to come in and do kind of a, you know, a process review, and them saying yes. So now I'm wondering if we won't see a wave of where we have, like you said, red states, red police unions, red governors, red legislatures, but like blue mayors, you know, these blue dots in these red seas.
Yep.
Saying, okay, well, I would like the DOJ to come in and, you know, take a look at Austin for a second, or, you know, what, well, I mean, there's a million cities that you could, yep, that you could name.
Yeah. Yeah. And we will just have to keep our eyes open and see if that happens. But, you know, it is all kind of part of, you know, dealing from the top down. You know, we're all in this together, cleaning up on aisle 45.
But so, I do love that, you know, I mean, if the blue mayor of this city had asked the Trump administration or the Barr Department of Justice, to, can you do a policies and practice thing? They'd be like, go fuck yourself. Yep. So, this is why we vote.
Indeed. All right. Next up, just a quick one. Just as President Biden promised on the campaign trail, the DOJ has also filed an appeal challenging the Texas ruling from July that the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, program is unconstitutional. They filed that notice of appeal in the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals to start the process to overturn what U.S. District Court Judge Andrew Hanen ruled on July 16th in favor of nine states, led by Texas, of course, that found that DACA violated federal administrative law. And I should amend my prior statement. This is a finding that the executive branch acted ultra virus and violated the Administrative Procedures Act. I mistakenly said unconstitutional. I meant illegal, null and void. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Gotcha. But apparently that ruling had stopped the United States temporarily from granting anyone DACA status, although Biden's Department of Homeland Security has continued to accept applications. So I feel like they kind of planned on this, this lawsuit. But DOJ isn't the only appeal filed here.
Yeah, because they're also private interest, right? So there are 22 DACA recipients, the Mexican American Legal Defense and Educational Fund, which is a nonprofit Latino civil rights organization, are all also part of the appeal because, right, this has policy implications, but also real world implications for real people. You and I have both talked about DACA on our respective shows. I try and use the language of enrollees, because DACA, it is not even the language of recipients, which is, you know, sort of neutral seeming, it could potentially imply, you know, they're getting government money. DACA more than pays for itself, right? Because not only in the filing fees and getting around, but then these people become eligible to pay taxes. That is the primary benefit of being a DACA enrollee. But roughly, like, here's the law really quickly. It is important to remember, unlike the DREAM Act, right? Unlike lots of things that are on the Democratic legislative agenda, call Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin and let's blow up the filibuster, right? DACA, because our legislature's broken, right? DACA was not a law. It was a policy, an executive branch policy implemented by Obama's Department of Homeland Security and by CBP, by U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, by ICE. Right. So the question was, did Congress delegate sufficient scope to DHS to craft a program as detailed, as specific as DACA? And look, this is a close legal question, right? You can believe, as I do, that DACA is a tremendous program. I just said it. The way to protect this is to pass the DREAM Act, right?
Yeah.
I'm glad the DOJ has appealed. It is going to a very conservative circuit court to a very conservative Supreme Court. And if you care about these issues, the way to protect it is to get rid of the legislative ambiguity and have Congress pass a law that says, yes, you can do this.
Well, we will keep, obviously, I mean, it's kind of our job here at Cleanup on Aisle 45 to keep track of all of these Department of Justice appeals, things that the Department of Justice is doing. I have a running list, Andrew, of things they do I love and things they do I hate. And right now, the things they do I love is probably about four times longer than the things they do I hate. And I have a caveat. Even though I hate them, they still may be the right thing. So I just, want to.
I like that list.
I want to clarify that.
Yeah. No, I think that's right.
But we do have our favorite segment coming up. We can talk about comings and goings. And this is a good one this week. I mean, you know, sometimes it's quiet, sometimes it's loud. And this one's loud. So we're going to talk about it right when we get back. Stay with us. Hey, everybody, it's Allison with Cleanup on Aisle 45, and today's episode of the podcast is brought to you by Feels CBD. If you haven't tried CBD yet, you must. I highly recommend it. CBD isn't about what you feel, it's about what you don't feel, like stress and anxiety and insomnia. Feels CBD is safe, organic, and has been really helpful for me with pain relief, nervousness, and insomnia, and there's no hangover or addiction. Feels is a premium CBD that will help keep your head clear and feel your best. It's hassle-free, delivered right to your doorstep. Feels has helped me feel calmer, less sore after workouts. That's my particular favorite part. It elevates my mood, and it's helped me sleep better as well. Feel the difference within minutes by placing a few drops of Feels under your tongue. Finding the right dose of CBD is very important, and everyone's dose is different, so you know. Feels offers a free CBD hotline to help guide your personal experience so that you find your perfect dose. The Feels customer service team is dedicated to making sure you get the best use of your CBD. Joining the Feels monthly membership makes your self-care easy. You'll save money on every order, and you can pause or cancel anytime. Very easy, and they have excellent customer service. Start feeling better with Feels. Become a member today by going to feels.com/cleanup, and you'll get 50% off your order with free shipping. I've never seen such an amazing discount. That's Feels, feals.com/cleanup, and become a member and get 50% automatically taken off your first order with free shipping. feals.com/cleanup.
And now it is time, as you teased before the commercial break, for everyone's favorite segment, Comings and Goings. Ooh. And we're not going to tease you any longer. You had to wait all the way to the C segment. So let's start with the goings, which include Kellyanne Conway. Allison, I know you have a special love for someone who just drips contempt over the Hatch Act and, you know, all of the kinds of ethical constraints that normal people have respected for decades.
Yes, yes. I'm so excited about this.
You are literally dancing. This is my favorite.
You know, a lot of people I found on the social media, a lot of people were like, what the fuck? They're still working for the government? Ah, yeah. In what took you so long news last week, the Biden administration told 11 officials appointed to Military Service Academy Advisory Boards by the former guy to resign or be dismissed. And this is his thing, right? I feel like this is kind of the sort of cornerstone of comings and goings. You have until 4 p.m. today to GTFO or we'll fire you. Resigning or fired. But very prominent names included here, like former White House Press Secretary Sean Spicy. Former, pretty much anyone who's been on Dancing with the Stars, former senior counselor to President Kellyanne Conway and former national security advisor H.R. McMaster.
Yeah, if you were wondering where that guy was.
Where was that guy? Serving on a Service Academy Advisory Board. They were appointed to advisory boards of the Naval Academy, Air Force Academy, and West Point, respectively. Somehow, even in their mere existence violates the codes set forth by those schools.
Yeah, I generally love Jen Psaki, and she did not disappoint in the press conference when asked about these moves. She said, quote, "The president's objective is what any president's objective is, to ensure that you have nominees and people serving on these boards who are qualified to serve on them and who are aligned with your values. I will let others evaluate whether they think Kellyanne Conway and Sean Spicer and others were qualified or not political to serve on these boards. But the president's requirements are not your party registration. They're whether you're qualified to serve and whether you're aligned with the values of this administration." Well, well said. And like, you know, yeah, yeah. I mean, Kellyanne Conway with her lifetime of involvement with the Air Force Academy. I mean,
and this is so great. There's some other names you might not, and me being a veteran and having a special place in my heart for the Hatch Act. Yeah, CAC can GTF. Anyway, some other names you might not know who are also super fucking terrible. Heidi Stirrup, the former White House liaison to the Justice Department, who was banned. First of all, why do we have a liaison from the White House to the fucking Justice Department? There should be a brick goddamn wall 100 feet high.
Yeah, right.
But anyway, I understand. Maybe there's a liaison to the Justice Department who was banned from entering the building after she attempted to access sensitive information about possible election fraud in December of 2020. Remember her? Yeah, apparently still there. And retired Colonel Douglas McGregor, former ambassador pick and Pentagon official, who said a bunch of xenophobic racist shit back in 2020, called for martial law at the border. Yeah, the guy who said, quote, "Muslim migrants were coming to Europe with the goal of eventually turning Europe into an Islamic state." As if that isn't what a Nazi would say.
Good to remind people that below the popular evil names are more evil. So just to round it all out, others who have been asked to resign include Michael Wynn, who was appointed to the board of the Air Force Academy, retired General John Keane, Megan Mobbs, David Urban, who were all appointed to the board at West Point, and John Cole and Russell Vought. That's Trump's former director of OMB. He was appointed to the Naval Academy's board. Vought, you might recall, is the guy who immediately tweeted out, "No, it's a 3-year term," to which Biden was like, "Well, then you're fired."
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Now, Spicy did the same thing on his, right? Did you know Sean Spicer has a show on Newsmax? I didn't know this.
I did not know this until today. Yeah.
Yeah, I found that out researching the story. I wish I could say I was surprised. Of course, the most attention came from Kellyanne Conway, who said she wouldn't resign and that Biden's decision is disappointing but understandable given the need to distract from a news cycle that has you mired in multiple self-inflicted crises and plummeting poll numbers. And I think at the end of her thing, she said, "I don't know, resign, you resign."
Well, the important thing is bye-bye to all of you idiots. And I wish you good luck in your doomed. No, I don't. I don't. That's lying. File your lawsuits. You're going to lose those too.
Yep, 100%. Bye-bye. And for the Cummings part, we welcome 8 new federal judicial nominees, bringing the total of nominees up to 43, which, again, are sorely needed.
Mm-hmm.
5 of these are district court judges. All of them continue Biden's commitment to genuine diversity. And 3 are critically important nominees to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 9th Circuit. Those 3 are Lucy H. Koh, the first Korean-American woman to serve as a federal appellate judge, and the second Asian-American woman to serve on the 9th Circuit from California. Gabriel P. Sanchez, and Holly A. Thomas, who will become just the second Black woman to ever serve on the 9th Circuit.
Yeah. And as usual, to ward off, you know, Uncle Frank and a diversity picks, right? These candidates have qualifications that are off the charts. Let's start with Judge Koh, who's currently U.S. District Court Judge for the Northern District of California. She's only been on the bench 11 years prior to her confirmation as a federal judge. She was also a California Superior Court judge. That's a trial court for Santa Clara County for 2 years. Before that, she was a partner in a big law firm, McDermott Will & Emery. Before that, she was at AUSA for 3 years. She was special counsel in the criminal division of DOJ for 4 more years, right? And all of that, the most important, the only qualification that matters, double-barreled Harvard, right? Graduating from the university in 1990 and the law school in 1993.
Double-barreled Harvard. I've never heard that term. And then there's Justice Gabriel P. Sanchez, who has been an associate justice on the California Court of Appeal, First Appellate District. That's California's intermediate appellate court for 3 years since 2018. Prior to being appointed to the bench, Justice Sanchez worked for 7 years in California state government, including a stint as deputy attorney general, kind of a big deal, and before that was in a big law firm. He only has a JD from Yale, though, so I'm sure you'll look down your nose at him, Andrew, but he was a Fulbright scholar, so you ought to cut him a little bit of slack.
that tends to have some qualifications. They tend to be slightly smart. All right. Finally, a Judge Thomas to be proud of. Judge Holly A. Thomas, who has been a judge in the Family Law Division of the Los Angeles County Superior Court since 2018. Prior to being appointed to the bench, Judge Thomas was Deputy Director of Executive Programs at the California Department of Fair Employment and Housing for 3 years. For 2 years before that, she was Special Counsel to the New York Solicitor General. For 5 years before that, she was an appellate attorney in the DOJ's Civil Rights Division. She earned the Attorney General's Award for Exceptional Service in 2014. For 5 years before that, she worked at the NAACP's Legal Defense and Educational Fund. Yeah, is just a lifetime of service, and particularly in the civil rights arena. And acceptable academic credentials. I mean, she graduated from Stanford, you know, in 2000, probably spent some time at the beach, and then slacker could only get into Yale Law School, where she graduated. In case you can't tell, I'm being sarcastic.
Yeah, oh,
these are not Justin's and Corey's coming out of Liberty University.
Or Trevor McGregor's. Yeah.
Ugh, God.
Well, here's hoping one day I raise a glass to this Judge Thomas replacing our current Justice Thomas. I think that would be fucking amazing. I don't, you know, it usually come from the D.C. Circuit Court, but it could come from Ninth Circuit.
Yeah, there's that. Look, what I love is Biden is illustrating that the bench is so deep and so rich, and it really just throws, you know, the Federalist Society hacks that we got used to for the last 4 years.
Yeah, like they were acting like, well, there's just no qualified nominees. I got to pick Trevor and Brad and Chaz because, you know, that's just all who's left. No, that's all who's left that'll do your fucking dirty work. that's all that is. The breadth and depth and diversity of this bench is fantastic. Now, if we could just double the size of the federal bench, maybe expand the Supreme Court a little bit, we'd probably be in a little bit better situation. But thank you for all of those comings and goings. Everybody, all these judges, welcome aboard. And to all the people who left this week, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Yeah. So this has been a great show.
And that's our episode.
Yeah. Awesome. Awesome show today. And I appreciate you, Andrew, and I already miss you from D.C. I feel like we're going to have to do another live episode soon, or at least a Zoom call. So if you're a patron, please stay tuned for any future information, which is coming shortly, on when we will have some sort of a live, either Zoom, virtual, or in-person meet and greet. It's coming quickly.
Absolutely. We can't wait. We love each and every one of you. We love our patrons more. And you know how to get into our special list. Patreon.com/aisle45pod.
I love you all, but you can apparently buy Andrew's affection for $1 an episode.
Yeah. No, I mean, they're just different levels. It's you know.
I love you, but I don't love.
Yeah, well, I'm not in love with all of you to the same degree.
I am. Anyway, I'm just kidding. I just like throwing you under the bus. We will be back next week with more of the same. So if you have any questions or concerns, you can hit us up on Patreon. And again, patreon.com/aisle45pod. We would love to hear from you. I'd love for you to be a patron. Until next week, I've been Allison Gill.
I'm Andrew Torres. And this is Clean Up on Aisle 45.
Clean Up on Aisle 45 is written, researched, and produced by Allison Gill and Andrew Torres, with editing by Molly Hockey. Our art and logo designer by Joelle Reeder and Moxie Design Studios, and our music is composed and performed by Adam Orr. Clean Up on Aisle 45 is a proud member of the MSW Media Network, a collection of creator-owned podcasts dedicated to news, politics, and justice. For more information, visit mswmedia.com.
Hi, I'm Harry Littman, host of Talking Feds, a roundtable that brings together prominent figures from government law and journalism for a dynamic discussion of the most important topics of the day. Each Monday, I'm joined by a slate of Feds favorites and new voices to break down the headlines and give the insider's view of what's going on in Washington and beyond. plus sidebars explaining important legal concepts read by your favorite celebrities. Find Talking Feds wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, parents. Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.